Mining has been the largest driver of South Africa's economy since the first discoveries of diamonds in 1867 on the banks of the Orange River and the gold rushes of Pilgrim's Rest, Barberton, and finally, Payload in 1886, the Witwatersrand gold rush. Though South Africa is still the fifth largest gold producer in the world, the gold and diamond production is well down from their peak, with many mining companies closing down shop altogether, leaving behind a devastation of joblessness, poverty, and environmental disasters in former mining towns. Over the past couple of years, there has been a rise in what are alternatively called zamazamas, artisanal miners, and depending on whom you ask on what day, illegal miners. People mining abandoned shafts in often very dangerous conditions and with reports of all sorts of unsavory activities in and around this unsanctioned mining. During December 2024, the entire nation's attention was pulled to an unfolding tragedy in Bevelsfontein in the Northwest Province as the police, the community and miners were in a standoff at the decommissioned DRD Stillwater operations. Within weeks, hundreds of dead bodies were extracted from the mine, hundreds more face an uncertain legal future, and many questions remain unanswered. Joining me today is Mametlwe Sibeyi, an attorney with the NGO Lawyers for Human Rights, who are among the various pro bono activists who have taken the government on regarding the treatment of these miners and the community at large. He's here to help me understand more deeply what is actually going on there now that the news cameras have moved on to the next big story. So, you know, part of the reason why this conversation is so important for us is because the cameras have moved on. On the news every day. And it's, in my view, the temperatures have gone down around the whole issue. Still Fontaine.
Yeah.
But there are still so many questions. And with your background and being part of the organizers, I think you are best placed to help us understand some of the nuances of what is still going on there, because the community remains affected. The miners themselves affected, and an ongoing process. So let's start here. Today, in Stilfontein, what is the mood like?
I'm going to, relay the story that was told by one of the ladies in the mass meeting we had. And I think it's telling of how people see what is happening there, what has happened there. He said, okay, now when we gave the report about the Risk Commission, you know, bodies have been retrieved, miners have been brought to the surface, the risk operation has closed. We had a mass meeting to give the report about that. And one of the, you know, lady said, that is very good. But now that the people are out, crime has went up in the community. People are so hungry. You now wonder whether your children are even safe when you send them to the shop because of the increased, you know, level of crime in the community. Now, there's a many levels to that perspective. One is how the community viewed the artisanal mining, the language they use, the fact that because when you listen to the public discourse and the popular narrative out there. No, the real crime was the one of artisanal mine itself. So what do these people mean? That the crime has went up when by this popular
narrative, by shutting down. Okay, so
we are supposed to be saying the police have clamped down on crime and now crime must have went down. But the community perspective says there are many robberies now. There is theft. Why? Because people are hungry. People are starving. People are unemployed. People are poor. People have no livelihood. In a community, in a distressed town affected by mine closures that were abandoned, actually, derelict and ownerless, many shafts, without any alternative means of livelihood. And people are therefore without any livelihood. This activity was actually at the very heart of the economy of that town.
But that raises a question for me that says, if you are saying the artisanal miners or the people who were underground, who now that avenue has shut down for them and they have turned to crime, but you're also saying, because that's what it sounds like. It sounds like those people, when they were under there, there was the crime in our community was less. Now they are on the surface and they are the ones perpetrating this crime.
Well, that's not a perspective I got. And I don't think I will say that. Let me tell you why I'm saying that. When this was said, all the miners that were retrieved were actually in the police stations, right? Or in the hospitals, or in the mortuaries. We convened a mass meeting of the community. But the issue is much bigger. It's about the economy of that whole community. It's about the economy of that whole town. And it's not just this community, by the way. One of the things that struck me was when I was with one of the comrades we deployed to organize there to support that community. And he says to me randomly that when he entered one of the big commercial retail store, people clapped hands for him. And he said, why? He said, well, because we had asked him to be doing few interviews. So they saw him on TV. And we were shocked because this was a white-owned, one of the big brands in the country. And they said, no, you are a hero and so on. But he was shocked because he thought almost everybody's agreed that, I mean, these are people in legitimate businesses. And why would they, you know, support him defending the miners who always say is that they've got to be brought to the surface alive. And if, you know, the state says that there must be accountability, we can then have that conversation about accountability for what. Now, he says the people, the manager in the store says, only people who don't live in Stilfontein can talk the way we hear people attacking. Since they've climbed down, even my shop, you know, talking a big retail shop, doesn't have clients. People, you know, we've seen, you know, because the economy of the entire town of Stilfontein actually rests on that. And I think when you look at the scale of the operations, thousands and thousands of artisanal miners were underground and they came to the surface in a very small town.
I want to talk a little bit more about the individuals that are part of this. But of course we understand that the economy of that town, the reason the town exists is because of this economy to begin with. Before there was DRD, there were lots of other mines in the and when they shut down, understandable, right? We see the ghost town Carltonville. I don't need to go five. If you just look at Boksburg and what's happened in Springs and Boksburg, as the price of the mineral has declined, what happens in those towns? So we understand that. But I think that there are a number of things at play. And let's get a little bit of context from you about, you say, thousands and thousands of artisanal miners underground, right? And the numbers, I thought the numbers were staggering. When I heard the numbers on the news of the bodies that were brought up, of the individuals who were rescued, I thought, this is a fully fledged operation that is a big company, really, right? How then should we be approaching this environment that is currently unregulated, that is currently, from what we hear and what we see from people such as yourselves, a free-for-all? So everybody does their own thing, which puts people at risk.
Yeah.
How then should we be engaging what's happening over there? And when we are holding people accountable, who do we hold accountable?
And that's the thing. I think people think we were there because we condone what is happening. Let's understand what we don't agree with. I'm a unionist. The idea that I can ever support people working in horrific conditions, right, without basic safety standards, health standards, in an environment where violence is actually a rule, an order of the day, people are killed with impunity, all of that. We can never agree to that, right? I'm very unhappy about conditions of my members in a formalized mining sector. That I can ever support what is happening there is outrageous. It's basically a slander, right?
So
the other issue is that the fact that we are oblivious to the plight of our communities, right? Because you are right, there's many levels to this. What is the level to this? Is that you have thousands and thousands of mainly former miners, their families, their communities that have been abandoned by the big corporate mining companies, right? Without jobs, without, you know, skills for alternative, you know, employment, without alternative means of livelihoods, in communities whose whole economy was centered on mining and without diversification because of the colonial nature of mining in this country. And I'll come to that. But the key fundamental features of that, colonial mining, is colonial extractivism, where the mining companies come here, extract minerals, don't beneficiate, don't diversify local economy, don't invest in any infrastructure, but also on the base of a cheap migrant.
So who do we hold hold accountable for that today?
We've got to hold those companies accountable. The companies are here, by the way. But I'll come to that. There's also another level. So because of lack of regulation, right? Lack of regulation, but also the criminalization of the activity itself. What it means is that the only way the artisanal miners are able to trade is through networks of illicit trades on minerals. And these networks have been created, established, and sustained by the big corporate mining companies in conspiracy with the tops of the political establishment, the police, the security companies, and so on. Because think about it.
What evidence do you have that this thing is exploitative of the miner and the people who are responsible for this exploitation go up to the highest level of government, as you say, politicians are involved?
Well,
what evidence do you have?
Let's use a deductive logic to start with before we go to evidence.
Okay.
The idea that those miners that we have seen that are completely emaciated, dehydrated, the miners that are living in shacks, absolute squalor, that those miners are able to transport, to export, and to trade in international markets. Because there is no local market for the minerals in this country, both for formal mining and artisanal mining. All of that need to be transported, exported, and traded in the international market. And the only way you can trade in those markets, firstly, you require license. And the licensing in this country is monopolized by the big companies. Right? So let's start there. But also, we basically, if you've been traveling the world, you know, you live in a, you know, police state. I mean, this one country where you can't travel.
Live in a police state.
Yeah, you can't travel for,
never.
I mean, 5 kilometers to 10 kilometers without encountering a law enforcement one or the other.
In this country?
Well, no, there are police everywhere.
I have not seen a police officer here in this Gauteng.
Well,
in this Joburg,
this
I have not seen a police officer in over 3 months.
It is because where we are. Right? This is Sandhurst, is part of Sandton. every policing is privatized. But the bottom line is, you cannot transport those minerals from Stilfontein all the way to the border with Zimbabwe in Limpopo, where also artisanal mining is developing rapidly, to the ports in Richards Bay in Durban, without the involvement of law enforcement.
This
I agree. And not only at local level. You need somebody who will be able to take a call to whoever police you encounter on the street and speak with that police on the authority and say, leave that person. Right? So it has got to be the tops of the police. But obviously, these minerals are transported under security. So the good companies involved with mining are involved. But let me then come to a practical evidence. Look, I know for a fact there are a number of instances. There is a community I represent around Roodepoort, by the way. So one of the our clients is actually a white part of that community is white community, because there is company that just wanted to build right in the middle of the suburb. They want to mine the old mine, but in the meantime, because of after decades, lots of those mines closed in the 70s. So lots of the housing there was repurposed, developed, and they were bought by the old white miners. And of course, young black things. Yes. So my clients, the community, had lots of, white community members. One of them, go to a police station for a meeting with a company, and he's there, and he say, when he's waiting, because he came earlier, and he said, why is he waiting there with a company in the boardroom? The admin at the police station come with a bag full of gold. He give to the mining company, and then he says, he go and ask the police, what is it? He said, no, that's gold from the Zamazamas. Okay. Then when the mine company people alert the person, the police people, that no, he is not with us. He may be white, but he's not with us. Then they said, the thing we get from the Zamazamas, we use it to do things in the police station that are lacking because of underfunding. I mean, since when are we funding police with a thing? But the escape also of Tiger, right? It tells you, Tiger could not have escaped with, just with those four police.
I do need to say this because some of the people who are listening may not have heard the story and the escape of Tiger or who Tiger is. So Tiger was one of the kingpins who was arrested at the time as people were being brought to the surface at Stilfontein, and under very dubious circumstances disappeared from the back of a police van. So context.
He was a henchman.
He was a henchman.
Yeah. I think for to who? Say a man
he's a henchman
who was for who? Found for the real kingpins.
Okay.
To say that a man found in that condition that he was would have been a kingpin, which in the language of the organized criminal syndicate is a top that require a level of control power. And in this case, top of an organization overseeing, an industry employing thousands of miners.
So
it couldn't be a poor person. The real kingpin can't be a poor person. But he was a henchman, implicated in cases of serious violence against the miners themselves. The community rescued him, brought him to the surface, handed him to the police. He disappeared. And I can tell you this much. You know, when I had a conversation with my wife said, what do you think? I said, no, by now all the henchmen have disappeared. I was actually shocked when he resurfaced. Right? I said, by now they probably find way of making all of them escape. And I'll tell you why I'm convinced of that. It cannot be true that one man oversaw an operations on behalf of the organized criminal syndicate, operations involving thousands of miners, one henchman. Right? Every police indication, every report we got from the miners showed that there is whole gangs that the real kingpins who are on the surface in the suburbs have luxury cars, staying in suburban mansions, are probably millionaires.
Mama, but I want to put to you, you say you are a unionist and an organizer, and this is part of the reason why you find yourself so involved in this environment. And you also then say that there's an implication all the way to the highest levels of our government. And I want to put to you that unionists are politicians too. Mm. So then they too are implicated.
Well, it is true that, the biggest trade union movement in this country is aligned to a ruling party. We consider ourselves a revolutionary union that want a complete overturn in the economic system. We want this
government. And so you are complicit then?
Well, not at all. We are absolutely opposed to capitalism. We are absolutely opposed to the private ownership of the economy, of the minerals, of the land that has been monopolized by the big corporations, domestic, foreign-owned. And we think that this government that facilitates that private ownership, that criminalizes resistance, must go away. It's as simple as that.
But you are in bed with them.
How? Do you say not? We are part of SATU.
Aligned.
Because SATU is aligned. We are not part of the alliance.
You're not part of the alliance.
I've never belonged to the alliance.
I'm
irreconcilably opposed to that alliance. I think ANC, I think the DA, I think all this capitalist party must be gotten rid of. I think that we need a working class power in this country. That is, workers organized in a political movement that can seize political power, but through that political power also seize economic power through nationalizations of the mines, of the banks, of the factories, of the farms, and all the key or the commanding heights of the economy, the mineral resources of this country, the land, so that we put this under public ownership. And on the basis of the democratic control and management of the working class, we can plan the economy in such a way that we mobilize the capacity in it, the wealth in it, in the interest of everybody to create jobs, to build the public infrastructure and services we need, and ensure better life for all.
That sounds like rhetoric to me. And why I say that is here you have an environment in Stilfontein, according to you, that gives an opportunity for this ideal situation, right? You have a community, you have mines that have been abandoned by their owners. You have people who have a skill that they can continue mining this environment, and they are members of this community. And yet, this community, the reason it is in the news in this way is because it has failed to organize itself into this ideal situation. These artisanal miners, the community that they live in, and with all of the infrastructure around them, have failed to organize themselves in this way. So it sounds like rhetoric to me.
That is because the ownership, including of those abandoned mines, remains privatized and remains monopolized. So let me give an example.
So I want to, before you give me that example, can I ask this question?
It also speaks to the issue of how the big corporations work with these gangsters. Right?
Before you give me that example, I want to talk a little bit more about the criminalization of the environment, as well as the fact that you now have multiple crime scenes. Whether you want to characterize the miners themselves as part of an illegal operation or not. Mm. What you now have there is you have multiple crime scenes. You have many dead bodies. Mm. You have a racket, essentially, that has taken place. As you say, they are henchmen. They are grievous kind of exercises that people have been put under these incredible situations. People have been coerced. People are bought out. What then today in this crime scene is the way forward out of this environment today? Not an idealized situation of let's overthrow the government. Yeah. That will not happen.
Okay. Let's start what can be done practically. So one, I think we're over the issues of rescue. I think those ones have been dealt with. Now, how do we move forward? There is 6,000 mines in this country that are abandoned, derelict and ownerless. Government is a narrative of how that came about. I can tell you, the serial corporate offenders, not only are they here with us, you have asked a question of who must be held accountable. They continue to be issued new mining licenses. So that problem is continuing. Right? Just to give you an example, because government will tell you that it has to do with the old legal dispensation. Even after MPRDA, that is Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act, after it came into place, I think 2002 and so on, between 2011 and 2016, 847, I think, or 43 mine closure certificates were issued, right? 87% of that were actually closure certificates for mining permits. Mining permits is for prospecting and, of course, you know, a short-term, small-scale mining, right? Only 27 mine closure certificates were actually issued for mining rights. Now, hear this. So this will be shocking. But this is not even the most shocking part. Of the 27 closure certificates for the mining rights, 20 of them were issued in Western Cape. Now, Western Cape, me and you know, doesn't have any of the minerals associated with heavy mining, right? It is mainly a quarrying of sand along the coast, which closure just and rehabilitation just means basically you come with a tractor, whatever that you use to the thing,
level
you're done.
The earth.
Level the earth, and you're done. So provinces like Limpopo, Gauteng, and so on, hasn't had closures of the mine. So in the course of abandonment of these mines, miners, their families, their communities get abandoned. There is horrific levels of unemployment and poverty in these communities that have reached levels of starvation and hunger that has forced people to take to mining in this horrendous condition, which I must emphasize again, we don't and can never support that type of mining. So let's be clear about it. My involvement actually in this is also, I think, as you are aware, I mean, I'm an attorney, as you say, advocate. I'm an attorney at Lawyers for Human Rights, in the Environmental Rights Program, Environmental Rights Program, which represent mining affected communities fighting big mining companies. So we have been, and these communities have been, advocating for proper closures of the mines. That means mines which are closed.
So what's the hold
they
up?
Need to be closed with their holes sealed, the environment rehabilitated for alternative productive uses. That may be amusement park, like the one you see at Goldreef, or for housing development, or for agriculture, whatever that you are. But there are those, and I think this is what government said when we wrote a report on the state of mine closures. They said of these 6,000, there's over 2,000 mining companies, I mean mines, that still have substantial amount of resources that can be mined. We said to government, expropriate those and, of course, recapitalize them to ensure that we have a very lawful and, of course, you know, proper mining that can employ people on the basis of decent wages and so on and so on.
But as we know, as of last week, we are broke.
So but I'm saying government can do that, right? And me and you can talk about how can be done, by the way. It is entirely possible. So the other issue is that to the extent that then you have these mines that are abandoned, these mines that still have some minerals that can be scavenged. Because I think we've got to contextualize this. What we are talking about here is miners who actually scavenge, right, on the minerals that are abandoned and are not wanted by anybody. So this idea that people are destroying the economy and others is just not true, because when those miners are not there, it just means those minerals go to waste, right? So how then do we resolve that?
Yeah, but
we need to resolve that. How do you resolve it? One, you find a way of regularizing it, right? So mining in this country, by the way, began as artisanal mining.
What then is the holdup?
You create a legal framework where small-scale miners can obtain license to mine lawfully. You can also assist them through business development training to ensure that they form themselves into cooperatives. That's one way of going about it. So you create a legal framework, you decriminalize. But also then you begin to provide support, right, with equipment so that they are able to mine safely and productively, so that they are able to earn decent living for themselves, their families, and of course for their communities. And you also then create a state buyer, right? In Zimbabwe, there's actually, I think it's this Fidelity something, it's a company I think known as Fidelity, but it's basically a central buyer of minerals in the country that is owned by the state and I think has monopoly on trading on that. Now, and when you do that,
and following,
you make sure that there is people are able to trade lawfully. And you can actually even put a marker so that they contribute to fiscus. And you use that money to ensure that the benefits of that mining are shared widely in the community by plowing that money into development of the local economies and communities that are affected by this.
No, and all of these on paper are wonderful ideas. All of these are wonderful ideas, and in the academics of it, of figuring out the various modalities of these things, anything can work. My question about the community, and I don't think you've responded to it sufficiently,
mm-hmm.
about the fact that you now have multiple crimes scenes here.
Yeah.
And what is the way forward? What is the way that, how do we resolve all of the today with the frameworks that we have in place? You have a community that has been devastated.
Mm-hmm.
You have a story that to the larger imagination of South Africans is an unbelievable story of desperation, crime, and every despicable human element living in that environment.
Yeah.
What is the, and you are a lawyer yourself and you work with these mining communities, what is the resolution?
So
today in Stilfontein.
Okay. Firstly, let's speak about crime of how those miners died. Those miners were stuffed and dehydrated to death by the action of the police, and the operation of which was conceived, executed with the approval of the tops of the state. There's got to be accountability for that. There's no doubt in our mind. And we are
pursuing your organization brought the application.
Yeah, we are pursuing that. We are pursuing that. You will see that, I mean, Human Rights Commission has instituted, you know, has elevated the investigation to a national inquiry. We are going to be fully engaging and participating in that, where we'll present evidence showing the betrayal and the treachery of the police conduct in that respect. So that's one. Two, we've got to deal with the problem of organized criminal syndicates, right? That have, parasite on the criminalization, on the lack of lawful or avenues for lawful mining, and of course trading on the minerals of the artisanal mining, right? And those are people who are responsible for a reign of terror. So when our communities are raising issues about the rapes, the murders, and so on, those issues are real. When we are not oblivious to that, if anything, we have been warning government that the unregulated development of artisanal mining at the back of industrial scale abandonment of mining shafts is going to give us a problem, is actually going to threaten not only the fabric of communities, safety in those communities, but actually is threatening the national security of the country itself because of the growing brazenness, you know, the level of organization of these, you know, syndicates and so on. So how do you deal with that? There's a way that actually this country has dealt with similar situation. The similar situation you can think about is actually a taxi industry, because when we talk about this, it has happened before in this country. I'll tell you what is the similarity.
Which in itself is a law unto itself, completely unregulated. We hear stories today of how taxi associations and the thuggery that says people in their own private vehicles, if they have two or more people in their own private vehicles, are being stopped on the side of the road because there's been a breakdown of law and order. But so I don't know if the taxi industry is
there is a problem, but let me tell you where we are and where we come from. There was a time, go and look at the figures, in the late 80s, early 90s, when I think, you know, number of people that were dying from a taxi-related violence was over 500, approaching 1,000 annually, right? Today you count, and I'm not saying we can condone all of that, but no person in this country, in his rightful mind, can still say criminalizing the taxi industry in a way that apartheid regime did is an alternative and will solve the problem. What happened? Taxi industry, remember, under apartheid in the 60s, 70s, government had monopoly over public transport. There had a company called, I think, National Transport Services that owned the airports, the airline, the trains, the passenger, the freight, the PATCOs. There used to be trams in this country. People have forgotten about them because me, when I grew up, only when I was born, they were no longer there. But you can hear about tram shed in Pretoria. Those were the station and so on. So when the neoliberalization began to come, you know, lack of investment in services began to develop, that system began to break down. And what happened? There was a vacuum. And people began to organically improvise ways of solving transport-related needs and problems in many of the townships that were sprawling.
Mamisi, right? But I have a problem with you talking with a forked tongue. Because on the one side, you want to talk about nationalization and the government must be in control. And on the other side, you want to talk about a completely owner-run and managed and industry like a taxi industry, which thrives because of the failure of the very government.
I don't support the model of public transport you have with the taxi industry, by the way. No, but I'm just saying to you how the problem was alleviated. Because even what we are proposing, and this is a point I said, right? We don't support, I mean, I can't imagine myself ever saying even the artisanal mining along the lines that we preach as an ideal way of living for our people. We can never. But we have got a problem, and we have asked, what is a concrete, immediate relief that can solve many problems? One, end criminalization of these miners. Make sure we isolate, ostracize, actually hold accountable the organized criminal syndicates that have stepped into the vacuum of an industry that there is no way you are going to climb down on it effectively through criminal justice system. It's not going to work. I can tell you all that.
Right? So what
there's
do you
over 100,000
criminal justice system. You can't climb down with the criminal justice system. So what do you
got to isolate the criminal elements from the disparate miners trying to make a living in conditions of desperation? That's the only way you're going to do it. What did they do with the taxi industry? So when the public transport system broke down, taxis develop. They develop against the framework of the law at that period. They were criminals. In fact, what we call taxi associations today, they actually were no more than gangsters. Let's be clear.
And they continue to operate as such.
It's the legacy of that whole history. It's because when government allowed that industry to develop unregulated for over decades, it became synonymous with an organized criminal thing. But today, many people will agree that there are many people in the taxi industry who just want to make an honest living. Lots of people owning one, two, and even multiple taxis, lots of drivers there are not criminals, are not syndicate members. They are just honest people who want to make a living in the taxi industry. We can agree on that at least. And how did that come about? In 1987, for the first time, government decreed, because in the 80s, when they saw they can't contain the problem, they just allowed it to develop, turn a blind eye. No longer criminal, but turn a blind eye. In 1987, for the first time, government developed a regulatory framework. And from there onward, right, there was regulatory framework, lots of what were organized syndicates that demarcated routes, allocated the spaces in the tech association through a barrel of the gun. Lots of them transformed and morphed into what? Into the current tech associations. What then happened? Lots of people in that industry who just wanted to make an honest living went perfectly legit, by the way, right? Some of them are respectable businessmen in their community.
Some. I like the fact that you are willing to... I like the fact that you are willing to acknowledge that a criminalized syndication, which is the idea that you are putting forward of a taxi, of the taxi associations, even in trying to morph it and shoehorn it into a legalized framework, mm-hmm. has not yielded the best result. And I give to you...
I disagree.
I give to you the examples of Uber drivers who mm-hmm. cannot pick up passengers. I give to you the example that we see time and again on social media of people that are being bullied by taxi drivers as they are trying to operate their Ubers. There was an instance at Maponya Mall where Ubers were set on fire. I mean, all of these things remain a problem to this day because trying to shoehorn an illegal system into does not work. I don't want us to be bogged down in the semantics of this particular thing, because I do also want to talk a little bit about your organization, Lawyers for Human Rights, and some of the work that you do, and very interested to hear your what's happened to your organization over the past couple of months with Donald Trump, and because one of your funders being USAID.
I wouldn't get funded from USAID.
Why is it on your website?
No. I think they might have funded one project or the other. I would be surprised. We did assessment about the impact, because it is going to impact the sector, lots of our colleagues. So it is our policy that every person who fund us, we put them on the website. So it may be that they funded a particular project. I know it's not going to have an impact. I'm not denying it's not important.
No, that's fine. Yeah. But there are various other organizations that are your funders, including Rosa Luxemburg, and Open Societies. Yeah. And a lot of criticism that has been hurled at organizations such as yourself, which seem to run an agenda that for many people looks like it is counter. And as you keep saying, the government has been warned by you for years and they're not listening to you, that you are running an agenda based on who is funding your projects for this fermentation or precipitation of these crises to collapse industry, as they were. And how do you respond to those kind of accusations?
But allow me to go briefly to the issue. So I don't agree that legalization of the taxi industry did not raise the better result. I think the reduced number of violence and people dying in the taxi industry is a positive result. When you look at the figure of people that used to die, 500 to 1,000 to where we are now.
Alternatively, they're just not reported.
The support that was given through a taxi recapitalization program, which allowed people to buy more safer, decent taxis, has improved record of safety and security.
And yet when you drive on the roads, the cars are a wreck.
We are not there, but I see there's been a massive improvement. That is my view. Anyway, let's get to the issue at hand. And I'm just saying that that's the way that you can go around the issue of the thing. You regularize, you support the miners, you create a state buyer to make sure that they can trade legally, and you isolate organized criminal syndicates who must be dealt with, prosecuted, and held accountable for all the crimes against the miners, against the community, and so on. On the issues of the funding, there is no doubt whether USAID funded one of our projects or not. I mean, I'm just saying that we are coming out of the strategic planning meeting of Lawyers for Human Rights. I know for a fact when we're doing risk analysis, they said, no, we don't receive any of the funding, but we do receive some funding from United Nations that itself get funding from US, and I think lots of UN agencies are going to suffer. So there will be an impact. But it's not just about Lois Freeman, it's our colleagues. So insofar as the agenda is concerned, and I can tell you with Lois Freeman what has happened. I mean, I, for one, has been a major proponent of that change, where we basically set an agenda, that we derive from communities we work with, and say, how then do we solicit funding to support communities and many working class people that are involved in the struggle in this country? Lots of people actually hear about our work with the migrants, because that's the one that is highly charged, right? But that's not the only work that we do. I represent many affected communities. Makua, by the way, barely has migrant workers.
In really?
Yes, mining affected communities, United in Action. These are communities of Marigana, because that's where it was launched in 2012, at the background of revolts in the mining communities. With the miners, I mean, there's the story of the miners, but that story raised a lot of issues about the mining industry and the exploitative character of it, the fact that it doesn't invest in development of community, all those things and so on. So there was a launch of Makua. There are many other communities that have since, you know, are out of the Makua that are in other forums and so on that we work with. I am tomorrow leaving for a launch of report with Skukune Combined Mining Affected Communities, right? Is communities affected primarily by Anglo-American operations in Skukune, where I come from. I'm also meeting, you know, communities, you know, affected by Bokoni mine, owned by Motsebe at the moment. These are South African communities, right? We have a workers' rights program at Lois Freeman Rights. We just won, you know, a very important case on minimum wage. We just won an important case, again, also in the past 2 weeks, two important cases. I think on the issue of the treatment of women, you know, who continue to be oppressed in workplace and so on. We have a land and housing program, by the way, which is the biggest law firm, insofar as I know, which deals with land reform, land restitution issues. Many communities, many important land restitution cases, including Malamala, which is the biggest, you know, was handled by us. So this idea that we don't derive our work from, you know, working class people in this country is just not true. Right? So it's because, as I said, most of the time, and this actually I criticize LHR for it, that we don't speak a lot, because people there just work. We don't speak a lot about a lot of issues in the work that we do. Right? So what then happens is that we then allow other people, normally we win court cases, you can search us, you will see, say land cases, workers case, you'll find our names everywhere. So other people, because these are cases which are popular with everybody, there are lots of commentators on them. When you are dealing with the unpopular subjects involving the most oppressed layers of the working class, in this case, always the migrants, right? They're the most oppressed, marginalized. Those are cases where the shortage of people to speak, and that's where Lois Freeman has normally come to the fore. And that's the reason people end up thinking that is our only work. In terms of how our agenda is shaped, as I said, is perfectly the issue of working with the oppressed. And let's just look at our history, because people that today are casting doubt on us. And I said this thing to when I had an interview recently and responding to the police minister. I said, if you say organizations like Lawyers for Human Rights is basically a hostile agent in conspiracy with, you know, foreign forces against, you know, the democratic project in this country, then you are guilty of treason. And I'll tell you why. The people we inherited this organization from, right? The Deputy Minister of Justice today is from Lawyers for Human Rights. The former Minister of Justice was a manager at Lawyers for Human Rights. the judges at Constitutional Court, right? With this judge Pillay, right? It's a former director of law firm. I can tell you about the people at the top echelons of the state. These are the people who build this organization. Many of us just joined recently. So, ANC government has to say to us, they've appointed at the highest echelon of the state in this country people they believe are part of the conspiracy against the state. Is that what they're saying? Why would you appoint as a minister of justice somebody associated with an organization whose origin, motivation, you are in question? I mean, that would be a treason on the part of government. You'll agree with me on that, right? You can't appoint people with such dodgy associations, right? You can't appoint people at a constitutional court with... So, this is an organization, by the way, that comes out of the legal profession. Those people in the legal profession in the 70s, in the aftermath of the suppression of the student movement, you know, the protests of the 70s, I think because it was founded out of the conference in 1978, right? So there were two organizations actually that came out of that. I think more or less three, but I think two that I'm aware of. One is Legal Resource Center. One is Law Firm. In fact, Legal Resource Center, the choice of the name was not is not by mistake. I mean, it's people who wanted to do the same work, but not the radical, the left wing of that legal profession. When to form Lawyers for Human Rights. This idea, the name that today sounds very normal, mainstream, was very subversive in the context of 1979, because these are people who had taken a position against apartheid and said, we are going to form a law firm that defend human rights of all, particularly of the oppressed black majority in this country. And we will continue to advocate also for social justice and so on, so for social justice and so on. So that is where Lawyers for Human Rights come from.
So you are subversive from the get-go. So it's in your DNA.
We are part of the National Liberation Movement.
It's in your DNA.
Of course. So, and we are proud of that history, by the way. The idea that we must sit here, in fact, under apartheid, you see, if there was ever a time where we're not transparent even about our funding, was under apartheid. Because from what I could see, because lots of the ANC people were actually, you know, we dealt with the issues of the loss of the ANC comrades on the death rows and so on in those days. In fact, that's when Lawyers for Human Rights, from what I can tell, was being used as a cover to channel funds illegally in the country for the ANC operations underground in the country at that time, in the struggle against apartheid. In the post-1994 period, when everybody now said, we agree about human rights, constitution was adopted, many of the principles of that constitution were developed by the lawyers that had been involved in this work and made enormous contribution. I mean, we were one of the law firm in the case that ended death penalty and many other cases that shaped the current constitutional dispensation. So since then, we've been more transparent than the Lawyers for Human Rights that was operated by a lot of the ANC people that today are in government. So if there is to be questions of, you know, this whole suspicion that has been cast, I would say, people that today are in government were far less transparent than ourselves. Now, were they justified? I think they were. Fighting apartheid is not a child's play. If you think you're going to fight apartheid and put all the cards on the table, well, don't ever dream about leading a revolution.
So I want to ask you to put yourself in an uncomfortable position for a second. Because you espouse a lot of, and as you say, left-wing ideologies and thought experiments. Is there in 2025 and going forward a third way that's not a completely capitalist or completely socialist answer to some of these pressing questions that you deal with in these mining communities?
I can't answer that as Lois Freeman does, but
as Mametu, it's not Mametu, for...
CV, I'm an old-fashioned Marxist. Right?
This may be a question for a conversation for another day.
I believe in the idea of the working class power, of revolution, of socialism. I think, in actual fact, the warning that was sounded by Rosa Luxemburg over 100 years ago, that the choice facing humanity is socialism or barbarism, that question has been answered so many times, that even as humanity develop, you know, technologies that today place a man on the space, that we are able to resolve many problems. I mean, think about, you know, where we are and you know, what people lived like 150 years ago. I mean, in the past 150 years, people moved from riding horses, still relying by and large on, you know, horsepower, as they used to call it, or, you know, animal power and so on, to moving with vehicles, to having aeroplanes. Now they can move with, you know, spacecraft, you know, all of those things and so on. We have achieved wonderful things, but despite all of that, billions of people in this country, I mean, in the world today, not in this country, billions of people are going to bed without the most basic necessities, not because of shortage. In fact, we have never had a richest civilization in the whole of human history than we have now. Yet, the misery on the other pole. And that's what Marx, you know, so analyzed. Capitalism can only develop by concentrating wealth on the one pole and extreme misery on the other.
So, but my question, and this is why I'm saying, for you, Mamet.
Yes.
Right.
There's no way out.
Why 100 years later do we continue to get it wrong? What would you posit?
Well,
as the reason we continue to get it wrong collectively, all of us.
The fact of the matter is, people contrary to what they think, capitalism is relatively very young. And I mean, on the span of human life, it seems very long, but it's, you know, just 500 years ago, 500 years old. But if you think about other previous systems like feudalism, it lasted over 1,000 years, right? From the end of the Western Roman Empire to the end of the Eastern one, and, you know, the end of the Middle Ages and so on. Now, we've only been under capitalism over 500 years. And in that whole period, like, of course, capitalism itself, which it didn't win in the space of 100 years, by the way. I mean, when you look at the development of the medieval cities that were the first macro, you know, cousins of or embryonic formation of capitalism within the framework of the feudal world of that time, right? Their struggles, their development was a struggle over a period not only of decades, by the way, of 100 years before capitalism became the main and the dominant mode of production and civilization. The working class in the past 150 years of the workers' movement, they've achieved a lot. They've built power. They have had, you know, great beginnings. There was a Paris Commune. There was Soviet Union. We have learned lessons of, you know, why these experiments and these victories were rolled back, why, you know, the advance was checked. But nonetheless, I'm absolutely confident and, if you like, fanatical about the socialist future of humanity. Because what other way out is there? Is a life of increasing misery for our people. And just look at South Africa, the most industrialized country in this continent. You have people dying on daily basis of fires in the informal settlements. You have a situation wherein our people in rural areas, in the very informal settlement itself, in the past weeks, they died in their tents, right? And from floods. That in the case of KZN, where you just said you come from and so on, it is a daily, I mean, it's a yearly recurrence, and people there are dying in their hundreds, right? Why? Just because of lack of proper housing, because of lack of basic roads with, you know, stormwater drainage systems and so on. People are dying of hunger, right? Droughts that are happening in the world where we are producing more calories than any other civilization, and there's abundance. 65 billion rands worth of food goes to waste every year. At the same time as over 10 million people are going to bed hungry in this country and so on. So there's a barbarism that you are dealing with under capitalism. The socialism that I believe in is a very simple yet a profound revolutionary idea. The idea that the working class, being the most oppressed, but also a class that is responsible by its labor for the creation of all the wonders and the wealth of our modern world, that through its organization, through its unity, through its struggles, it can organize not only to build its power to resist against the onslaught, against austerity, against exploitation and oppressions in the current system, but to seize political power and to create worker states that will be based on a democratic organizations of the working class, the civics, trade unions, and all of those things, or factory committees, Soviet, whatever that you call them. And on the basis of that power, they'll also seize economic power and break the economic dictatorship of the elite. The fact that today, think about it, decisions about whether me and you have a job or not, whether me and you eat or not, how much is invested in housing, education, health, are taken by a tiny elite of undemocratically, of unelected, unaccountable, cooperate bureaucrats and their shareholders without any one of us having a say.
I absolutely disagree with you on that, because there are legal frameworks and you are a lawyer. So you know that legal frameworks are the belief system that we, once we have voted, believe that our country, our economy, our lives are governed around this framework. And I love that you are this passionate.
No legal principle.
Hold on. I love that you are this passionate about your idealism. I really do, because I think that that passion is what allows you to fight as hard as you do every day for the communities that you work with, regardless of where they may stand at a point in time in opposition to what the legal frameworks say. And I really appreciate that you came, and I know it's late and you've had a long day of community engagements. I really appreciate that you took the time to share with us some of the nuances of not just that particular community, but many other communities around the country that live in similar circumstances. And I appreciate you for that. I appreciate you for that. And I hope your passion holds you in good stead for the long haul of the revolution.
Thank you. I mean, just to say, for me, like, the idea that our crisis is because of other people who are poor like us coming to this country is the reason we don't have jobs, is the reason we don't have services. It's just not acceptable. It's just not true. At the same time, you know, I had a conversation with a community of Bokoni when there was elections to say, the people promising you jobs have no power to decide on whether you have jobs or not. At the time of the 2014 election, there was an AGM of Anglo in New York at that time. I said that AGM is far more important on whether you're going to have jobs in this mind than these elections. Well, what happened? that AGM decided to close the mine.
Close their mines and move operations.
Which employed 12,500 people. When they voted a party, that told them they are going to create more jobs and not destroy one. Right? The people unelected in New York decided 12,500 jobs are going to be lost. The people they voted have no power on that. When now the jobs are lost, they go to the community and say, well, the problem is not the people in New York who decided to close this mine and destroy 12,500 jobs. The people that are a problem and the reason don't have jobs is because of few Somalis who own a spaza shop in your community. That is barbarism of capitalism, is a scapegoating reflecting the bankruptcy of the bourgeois politicians in terms of lack of way forward and the way out of their crisis. But that is all the more reason we have got to be organized, we have got to be united, take political power, make sure that we put the mining industry like Bokoni under public ownership, get those mine workers, community civics, into a board of directors of that mine and ensure that mine work for that community, provide jobs, and what remains after paying those workers decent wages is plowed in the development of that community to employ tens of thousands more people in beneficiation of the minerals and to revitalize and reindustrialize many vast parts of this country and create more million jobs to abolish unemployment, poverty, and the suffering that comes with it.
I think that's a good place to end.
Thank you.